Some things shouldn't be transparent, like stop signs. But what you pay for should always be clear, like Hiller's True Transparency Pricing, always clearly itemized and never any hidden fees. Because you have the right to know what you're paying for. For more information, visit happyhiller.com/true-transparency-pricing. Happy you'll be, or the service is free.
Call the Happy Face Truck today.
Francesco Molinari wins the Open, and with more, here's John Feinstein. You tweeted out, and I mentioned this earlier in the show, what Molinari has done in the last couple of months has been crazy. He's won three tournaments, and he's only had one bogey on the three weekends combined in those tournaments.
Yeah, that's astonishing. And to do it the last 36 holes at any major, much less at a major at Carnoustie, which I think is as hard as any golf course in the world. I tweeted this too, that the first time I played there years ago, one of the guys I was with was Hubert Mizell, the late columnist from St. Petersburg, Florida. And we got to about the 13th hole, and Hubert turned to his caddy and he said, "When do we get to the easy holes?" And the caddy said, "When you get to St. Andrews." And he was right. I mean, Carnoustie's just really hard. And to go through the last two rounds of a major championship there without a bogey, and as you said, Jonathan, winning three events with one bogey on the weekend. That's one bogey in 108 holes. That's just astonishing. And he was a deserving winner. And I know that most of my media colleagues were trying to root Tiger Woods home, but the best player won without any question.
John, what is the player's favorite Open course on the rotation?
Yeah, favorite. That's a good question. I know they would all say Carnoustie's the hardest. I think it's divided up. Some would say Carnoustie because it's so hard. Some would say St. Andrews just because it's St. Andrews. And others would say Turnberry, which is the most scenic of the Open courses by far. It's kind of the Pebble Beach of Scotland. So it really depends. And Muirfield is highly respected, too, because it's also very difficult and very fair. It's interesting, isn't it? You never hear the players complain about the course setup at the Open Championship, because what the RNA does is they just let the course and the weather dictate how the players play. And they don't speed the greens up, and they don't trick up the rough. And, you know, if somebody, you know, at Troon a couple of years ago, there was no wind, and Henrik Stenson shot 20 under, and Phil Mickelson shot 17 under, and the world didn't collapse. In fact, everybody said, "Wow, wasn't that a great performance by the two of them?" Because Mickelson was 11 shots ahead of J.B. Holmes, who finished third. So that's one of the things I love about the Open Championship. And to me, it's the best of the four majors. I know you asked me that question last week, and this weekend I think we again saw evidence of why.
It was so much fun, John. And for a lot of people, a big reason for that fun was Tiger Woods being in contention and in the lead on Sunday. It still amazes me. There are so many great players out there, and it's a great time for golf to watch any weekend. But there's still only one Tiger Woods. And the power of Tiger Woods to bring in the common viewer continues to astonish.
Yeah, and it does astonish. And it's not just, Chad, that people want to watch. Now, I get that part of the equation. He is, as I've said to you before, I think the greatest player ever. All due respect to Jack Nicklaus. And I know Jack Nicklaus won 18 majors and Tiger's won 14. But when Tiger Woods was dominating the sport from 1997 to 2008, he did things that no one, including Jack Nicklaus, has ever done. I mean, he won a U.S. Open by 15. He won a Masters by 12. He won an Open Championship by 8. He won 4 in a row, 7 of 11. I mean, I could go on and on with the things that he did during that 12-year period, counting 2008, when he won the U.S. Open. And that was the last major, as we know, that he's won. So I get that part of it. You know, can the greatest player of all time, or even if you're a Nicklaus guy and you say the second greatest player of all time, be a good to great player again. I get that. What I don't get is the passion from people, which I see all the time, who are dying to see him win. Because the reason he fell, I mean, injuries became a part of it later, but the reason he fell from his pedestal was because he did horrible things to his wife and his children. And he's never been a particularly good guy. I think he's been better this year. He hasn't stalked off after, you know, poor rounds. He stood and answered questions from the media patiently. He's been very good about that. And we haven't heard the F-bombs we used to hear. In fact, when he hit that terrible shot at 11 yesterday, which was the turning point, he said, "Oh, my God." And so I give him credit. He's improved. But it's not like this is one of the great guys of all time who's making a comeback. I wrote a column about the whole Tiger Woods phenomenon on golfworld.com today. And I said, if you really want to root for a comeback and be awed by a comeback and cheer for a comeback, why not cheer for Serena Williams, who almost died giving birth 10 months ago and then came close to winning Wimbledon? Why not cheer for John Lester, who came back from cancer to be part of two different World Series winning teams? Why not cheer for Eric Compton, who came back from two heart transplants to finish second in a U.S. Open? To me, those are heartwarming stories. Tiger's story is a fascinating one, but I don't find it heartwarming.
Maybe Michael Jordan doesn't fit the bill because there was an air of mystery about him. But, Tiger Woods, not the greatest guy. Pete Rose, not the greatest guy. Lawrence Taylor, not the greatest guy. We don't hesitate to root for guys who are supremely gifted who maybe are not the greatest guy. And I just wanted to get you to kind of pick up where you left off taking that in.
Well, again, I get, Paul, the fascination with watching them perform. I mean, Jordan was unbelievable. It's funny you bring Jordan up because in this column I mentioned I referenced Jordan's time with the Wizards. And I said, you know what? If you were just looking at this guy and didn't know who he was, you'd say he's a pretty good player. He averaged 21 a game during his 2 years with the Wizards when he was, as we called him here in Washington, Fat Jordan. but compared to Chicago Jordan, who 8 times averaged more than 30 a game, and knowing he was that guy, it was at times hard to watch. And this Tiger Woods is a good player. I mean, he's a very good player. He's had 4 top 6 finishes this year, and has played, had chances to win a couple. I mean, realistically, he could have won in Tampa. He could have won yesterday. But he ain't the Tiger Woods we were watching from 97 to 08. And I think people keep wishing that Tiger Woods would come back the way people in Washington wish that Michael Jordan would come back. They're not coming back. Age does it to everybody. And time off does it to everybody. Injuries do it to everybody. But I can see why you would want to watch the greatest players. I mean, it's not like John McEnroe and Jimmy Connors were considered great guys when they were dominating tennis. But people love to watch him play. People love to watch him compete. Then when they got old and they weren't as good, I remember McEnroe saying this to me when he was at the peak of his powers. He said, you know, someday maybe when I'm old and I'm not winning anymore, people will root for me. And that's exactly what happened. And I think there's a certain element of that with Tiger Woods right now. He's not the unbeatable, untouchable Tiger Woods. He's vulnerable. He's been vulnerable. And so people, tend to gravitate towards seeing him play well. I get that part of it. But the other thing, Paul, is I think because of what I've done for a living, because I've known so many athletes, I've known great athletes, I've known not great athletes, I've known great guys, I've known not great guys, I tend to root for the people who I think are good guys. That's why I pull for Rory McIlroy, because I think he's really a good guy. That's why I pull for Jordan Spieth, because I think he's really a good guy. But I have more trouble pulling for Tiger Woods, and Phil Mickelson falls somewhere in between. He's always been good to me, but I've seen that side of him that can be not appealing too, as we saw at the U.S. Open.
Do guys get ready for those pot bunkers by simply finding a steep sand trap or saying, hey, I need to hit this 6 feet in the 6 feet in the air immediately without a wall in front of them? I'm curious how people that don't play that all the time get
practice out of the pot bunkers before an Open Championship or before an event where they're going to have to deal with them. But one of the things you got to understand, Paul, is these guys are so good that even though the pot bunkers are more difficult than a regular bunker, it's not like they look at it and go, oh my God, what am I going to do? They're still going, hey, how do I get this close? Because they're that good. They play a different sport than the rest of us do. And so, yes, they'll certainly practice out of pot bunkers when they know they're potentially faced with them. The guys who win at the Open often don't get in one or only get in one for 4 days. I mean, they know where they are, and they try to make sure that they don't find them. And, of course, Tiger hit that incredible shot out of the pot bunker at 10 and then played 11 like a hacker. It was weird.
I know this is probably your favorite build-up to a conversation, but I got a book idea for you.
Uh-oh. I just got a book idea today that you wouldn't, if I repeated it to you, you wouldn't believe it.
Well, hopefully,
go ahead. Yours has to be better.
Yeah, hopefully you won't be saying that about this. This frat house of players. Hutton gave us the list of guys who were staying together. If they're doing this at four majors and would actually be themselves and let you in, if you could write a year of major tournaments plus these soccer tournaments they're playing at the house, I'll pay for the jet on the way home if I win, I would soak that up.
You would soak that up. Well, to me, honestly, I mean, most of the guys who were involved in the one this weekend are guys I know and I get along with pretty well, or in some cases very well. To me, it's a bunch of rich guys. You know,
I like rich guys. I like reading about rich guys because they're unlike me.
You know what I did this morning? Most of this morning, I watched the end of the Barbasol Championship because that fascinates me. You know, what does it do for guys who are trying to win? For, you know, a guy like Troy Merritt who hadn't won for 3 years.
You've done that, though, haven't you? You wrote the...
What? I did, but it still fascinates me, and I know a lot of those guys, too. Like a guy like Steve Wheatcroft, who I first met at second stage of Q School in 2005, had a chance to really make a move this week, finished tied for 10th, which was good, but not good enough to get him back in the top 150.
I'm taking this as a hard no.
It's a soft no because it's you.
That's a hard pass.
If it was some guy,
how about an article?
If it was some guy sending me a note through my website, and I encourage people to contact me through my website, by the way, at Jay Feinstein Books. I'm always glad to hear from people.
I look forward to a long article on it.
That's possible. But only if they give me complete access and I get to eat that food that this great chef is allegedly making.
John, do you have any interest in collaborating on a documentary in any way, or is it just written form for you?
I've been involved in documentaries, Chad. I mean, we did one based on Caddy for Life on Golf Channel. I wanted to do one on the Army-Navy rivalry. It's 8 or 9 years ago now. I sent Sean McManus, the president of CBS, a proposal. Sean and I went to college together, and I said, why don't you do this? Why don't you do it in two parts? Air part one on Showtime, which CBS owns, the week before the Army-Navy game. Use it as a build-up to Army-Navy. Use it to promote Army-Navy on CBS. And then air the second part the week after the Army-Navy game and focus it on the Army-Navy game and the kids who play, and basically kind of like a Civil War was in book form. And Sean wrote me back and said, well, you know, the only sports we're doing on Showtime right now is boxing. Okay. A year later, I get a call from a friend of mine at CBS who says, hey, have you heard we're doing a documentary, a two-part documentary on the Army-Navy game? We're going to air part one on Showtime the week before the game and part two on Showtime the week after the game. So I wrote back to Sean and I copied the email I'd sent him a year earlier. And I said, I hear you're doing exactly this. And what the blank? And he wrote me back. He said, oh, no, this is different because we're going to go behind the scenes. I said, what the hell have I been doing for 25 years, Sean? Come on. Don't BS a BSer. And I actually called a lawyer to see if I had any legal grounds. And he said, did they solicit the idea? I said, no. And they said, well, if they didn't solicit the idea, then you have no legal grounds. So they went ahead and made the documentary. I didn't think it was very good, but the answer to your question, long-winded, Chad, is, yeah, there are definitely documentary ideas I've had and still have.
So Josh Hader, he has these tweets exposed, the offensive tweets, during the All-Star game from when he was 17 years old. What did you make of the standing ovation he received at the Brewers game in his return?
I found it troubling. I think the way Hader handled the release of those tweets was excellent. You know, he stood up, he didn't duck anybody after the game. He answered, he said, look, I was young, I was stupid, that's not who I am. His teammates backed him up, which gives him more credibility in my mind. So, and I think everybody deserves a second chance. Now, the tweets were really hateful. And you have to wonder, you know, how the hell he grew up that he would be tweeting stuff like that. But, you know, we all make mistakes. We all do stupid things when we're teenagers. He said he was sorry. He said that's not who he is. I'm willing to forgive and move on. But a standing ovation? Really? You give a guy a standing ovation because, basically, I guess, because he admitted that he did a terrible thing. I think you deserve forgiveness, but I don't think you deserve a standing ovation. And I think it's worth noting, unfortunately, it's worth noting that most of the crowd was white. I can't imagine an African American or somebody who was gay giving him a standing ovation. Maybe forgiving, but not giving him a standing ovation.
John, I want to circle back to the Open briefly because I don't know when we'll talk again about Bernhard Langer. But I thought one of the most amazing things was at 60 years old, finishing under par on the hardest course in the Open rotation. Many guys could have won that tournament yesterday, but I'm not sure many guys, he'll be 61 next month, could finish under par on that course.
Yeah, I mean, it is worth remembering, Jonathan, that Watson almost won at 59, almost 60 at Turnberry back in 2009. But I agree completely with your premise. Langer is a wonder. He is absolutely a wonder. A couple years ago at the Players' Championship, I ran into Martin Keimer getting on the elevator at the hotel after one of the practice days. And I said, how'd your day go? Some casual question. And he looked at me and said, I played with Bernhard today, who, of course, was his hero growing up in Germany. And he said, he can still hit it as far as I do. And Keimer's not short by any means. I mean, we're talking about a two-time major champion here. He said, I can't believe how good he is. Now, this was 3 years ago, maybe, when Langer was only 57. But you're right, Jonathan. He is an absolute wonder, not only the way he's been dominant on the over 50 tour, but the fact that, as you said, he can go out on arguably the hardest course in the Open, Rota, make the cut, first of all, shoot under par, and deal with that golf course. Amazing. Truly amazing.
John, we always enjoy having you on, and now your wife can have the phone back.
Yes, and believe me, she wants it.
Thanks, John.
Talk to you next week.
Talk to you next week.
John Feinstein with us each Monday at 12:15 here on the Midday 180, served up by Wendy's.